about Gabe Brown. It's about all of us coming together and finding common ground for common good.
Absolutely, 100%. Thank you again, Gabe.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been EcoJustice Radio and our show, Farming for the Future, The Regenerative Way. Thank you to our guest, Gabe Brown, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You have been listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer, myself, Jack Eit, co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning into KBOO Community Radio for this special programming campaign, All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3. This February and March, you will hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our talented volunteer programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to help KBOO reach our $22,000 goal by March 16th, go to kboo.fm/give or text the letters KBOO to the number 44321. Do it right now.
KBOO. And next, the last installment of our Black History Future Month series. Tonight, we're going to hear from two Black Panther activists and leaders currently in exile in Tanzania, Africa. We're going to hear from Charlotte Mama C and Pete O'Neill. Your host will be Sincere Alicia Kerr.
Mama C, bring us in.
Okay, here I go. What a blessing to pour libations today in honor of our ancestors, in honor of our freedom fighters, in honor of the Maroons. And may we all continue to be blessed with the Eshu that we are covered with. And may we all continue to walk in steps of freedom, love, and blessings. Omi tutu, ona tutu, ile tutu, tutu igun, tutu maroye. And may all of the nature spirits surrounding us continue to protect, elevate, and give us permission and the honor to spread love wherever we walk. I give thanks.
Ashe.
Ashe.
Very, very good. And I hope, it's my hope and my desire that all of us, each and every one of us, can maintain and keep that fire in the belly that keeps us going, that inspires us to stand up to the most powerful nation state that has ever existed and stand up and look at them eyeball to eyeball and don't blink. That's what we've done thus far, and that's what I intend to keep doing for as long as I'm breathing. So I'm ready. Let's get it going. Beautiful.
And know that I will always be by your side.
Right on, right on.
Yes, yes.
All right. Now check it out, y'all. I want to welcome ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, healers, artists, the world, into the People's Dinner Party today. Today, we have the real life Django Unchained people right here. One of the greatest love stories our planet has ever seen.
Yes, yes.
Mr. and Mrs. Pete O'Neill is in the house in the dinner party, the People's Dinner Party today, blessing us today with their presence and their story. This podcast will be geared around their love and their connection, not only just for each other, but just as important for the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mama C, co-founder of the United Alliance Community Center, founded in 1991. She co-founded with her husband, who is also, we are blessed to have with us here at the People's Dinner Party. She's a mother, a healer, an artist, an activist, an agent of change. She's published two works, Warrior Woman of Peace in 28 and Life Slices, A Taste of Magic in 2016. She joined the Black Panther Party in Kansas City in 1969. Also, she was a part of the Kansas School of Human Dignity as well. Mr. Pete O'Neill, or Pete, former chairman of the Kansas City chapter of the Black Panther Party. Following the steps of his pops, he went into the Navy. At the time, a lot of the leadership was under duress of the party by local police department and FBI. At that time, Mama C and Pete left the United States and went to Algiers to join the group known as the International Section under Eldridge Cleaver, Eldridge and Kathleen Cleaver, and later went to Tanzania and set up a beautiful community center there. And with that, look, years ago, both these folks helped me out in a time of need. I am so blessed. You're talking about almost maybe 30 years ago, I reached out to Pete to help Lawrence Taylor, a former Panther out of New York. And he was so gracious and gave me all his telephone numbers, including the telephone number to his Jeep. And I never forget acts of kindness. And I researched his name and you guys' story. It touched my heart so. And to see y'all come alive at the Panther Reunion UDC in my home town, Washington, D.C., to see y'all come alive in that PBS special, Panther in Africa, I was floored. I must say this. I want to say this. If I never do another interview in my life, this would be the greatest interview I ever done. This is how much these folks right here mean to me. This is how much Mama C and Pete mean to me. you know, the ability to leave this country and take that love with them and go back home and reestablish the love for our people, with our people in Tanzania. And with that, Mama C and Pete, I'm a kick back and tell the world your story, your love story, and your love for us as well. Welcome to the People's Dinner Party.
Thank you
very, very much. And we are honored to have been able to continue the work of the Black Panther Party. A lot of people have a misunderstanding about the Black Panther Party, due in large part to misinformation spread by the media and COINTELPRO. They want to talk about guns and violence and shooting. And yes, that was part of it, because we are not principally nonviolent. We believe strongly in defending ourselves, and violence will occur. But that is not the basis of the Black Panther Party. The basic aspect of the Black Panther Party is to serve the community. That and nothing more. We've done that for all the years that we've in Kansas City, in Algeria, and most certainly here in Tanzania. We try to make an uplifting contribution to the neighborhoods, to the environments in which we live. We have here in Tanzania, we have a community center that serves the youth. We have a children's home that serves children. Now, you can talk about underprivileged people, you can talk about poverty, but if you haven't witnessed some of the lack of that exists on this continent, you haven't observed it at all. It's a grinding poverty. And
yes, sir.
We have tried to make a dent. And as a matter of fact, we have yes, taken children. We have taken them through school, from primary school. What is primary school? I love Patrick. Through primary school and through, we've got them through secondary school. Some of them now on their own, with their own determination that we hope we instilled in them, have entered university. We are proud of what we've done. And we've done this with no money. We didn't make a nickel out of it. We've had to do everything by flying by the seat of our pants, but we get it done. We get
all
it done
the people.
With an absolute determination, and I am so proud. And a lot of people say, how in the world can you all be married for 54 years and haven't killed each other? How can you possibly do that? That's an impossibility. No, it's not. It depends upon the foundation that your relationship is built upon.
Right.
Our relationship is built upon what I just tried to describe to you, serving the people, something that's much bigger than Pete O'Neill, something that's much bigger than Charlotte Hill O'Neill. This is something that stops any kind of nonsense. She'll get mad at me, I'll get mad at her, mouth will get stuck out, we'll fuss for a little bit, and then you stop and say, wait a minute, this is not what we are about.
Right.
This is not about Pete, this is not about Charlotte, this is about working for the people. And so we do it, and we do it with a will, and I'm so proud, and I'm honored that there are people like yourself, comrade, who take the time to say, I want to let the world know about this.
You best believe it.
Something good is in the works, and something good is happening, and something that we all should be very proud of.
Right.
And I'm
very proud. And I think that young lady, I got a young wife, man. I don't know how I did it, but I got me a young wife.
Sound like a sound like a relationship book in the making. How to keep it together.
That's all it's got to be done.
Yeah. You
put down paper and it will be there.
Right on.
That's right. People always ask me also and say about, you know, how we've been able to, you know, be together for 54 years and counting, you know, and I say everything that you said, the community service aspect of it, that is in our blood, that's in the marrow of our bones, and that we learn as members of the Black Panther Party and have carried that on. But it's also an element of trust,
right on.
Element of honoring each other.
Right, you know,
I think those are some big elements that make our relationship what it is today. And also knowing that we're an example. We're an example to our community. We're an example to the youth. You know, we're an example to the world, because you don't see many people, especially these days, staying together, not just striving, but thriving for more than 5 decades, you know, right. And still friends. Hey, uh-huh. You know, that's really, really something. Still in love and still building dreams and manifesting these dreams. And MJ, I tell you this all the time, I'm so honored to be your wife. I think that I know that this was something that was meant to be, because a whole bunch of people wouldn't have left together, especially at my tender age of, I was 19, right?
You were 18, you had just turned 18. She was legal. She had just turned.
When we met, but I was 19 when we left.
Yeah. You were 19. You're absolutely right.
Yes, yes. Now, how many people would have done that? But I remember you asked me, I don't know if we was getting ready to get on the plane or getting ready to get in the trunk of that car or whatever it was, but you said, you sure you want to do this, Sister Charlotte?
Sure did.
And I said, Brother Chairman, I used to always call you Brother Chairman or Brother Pete, and now I call you MJ Pete. That's why when young folk like our brother Sincerely say just Pete, it makes me feel funny, because he's our elder. He's my elder. He's my husband, but I still put something in front of his name. But you got permission, brother, so don't worry about it.
And I feel very honored to be able to call him Pete. That's why I had to think about it, be like, okay, he said it's fine to call him Pete, because I'll be wanting Mr. Pete and Baba Pete. That's the first thing to come to mind. But I'm definitely honored. Thank you so much.
I said, of course, you ain't gonna leave without me, huh? We've been on this adventure together ever since, and it has been sometimes a wild ride, huh?
Right.
But it's always been good, and I've learned so much from you, MJ, and you just continue to inspire me.
You learned me, sister, how to love. You did, and you know I'm not I don't show emotion easily, and you taught me, showed me how to show that, how to express that, and so I benefited a great deal from my relationship with you. But I wanted to add a little something to the story, because you didn't tell it the way I would have. It was the white left in New York City that got us out of the United States. They wanted me so bad. Clarence Kelly was the chief of police, my nemesis.
Right.
He became the director of the FBI when J. Edgar Hoover died. Hated the ground walked on. He did, and it was the white left that organized everything, got us to New York City, put us in a safe house, got the tickets and got everything.
Wow.
And this little white dude, he was a lawyer, wasn't he, Charlotte? Mm-hmm. Just scared to death, was driving us to the airport, hands shaking and everything, and they were listening to the radio, and a little tinny voice kid was singing, "I'll be there." That was 12 years old. So I said, "We need to remember that song. That'll be our song." I said, "Because you never know. We may be gone for up to 2 years." It was 20 years before Charlotte went back to the States, because we were getting on the plane. We're getting on a SAS to go to Sweden. And I said, "Charlotte," I said, "you don't have to do this now." I said, "Nobody, you can go back to the States." She said, "Brother Chairman," and this is an expression that was used then. She said, "I'm down for doubles." That means I'm in it with all 4 feet. I'm in it absolutely. I'm in it till we win, you know. And she has been there, and the electricity just came back on. Now I have no idea.
Down like 4 flat tires.
This has been an absolute blessing. We have grown. I grew up in Tanzania. Now, I had just turned 30. Just a couple of months before, turned 30. Just the 27th of July, I turned 83 years old.
Yeah.
And I have been so blessed. Wow. I remember when 1970 was coming in, Charlotte and I were standing at the window, and we were hellraisers. We really were. That was just, I could put it in a nicer way, but we were hellraisers. And I said, "Sister," I said, "you know we're not going to live to see another New Year." She said, "I know it." She said, "Let it come on, bring it." 83 years old. Now you tell me I'm not blessed. You tell me fate has not placed its hand on my head and said, "Let it be." Yes, something good has happened. And so what an honor it is. So I'm here with this lady. We're doing good work. We're doing good work together. We serve everything. We have provided ambulance service in the community. We have taught classes. We've taught computers. We've taught so many things. And it has never cost anyone a cent. And we don't have any money other than what good people that support us, that believe in us, the little bit of donation that they do. And always, always, something that will happen to keep us going. There have been, am I talking too much, Charlotte?
No, sir.
Keep on.
Please.
Many, many, many times when I told Charlotte, I said, "Well, Charlotte, I don't know what we're going to do." I said, we're at the end of the road now. Charlotte told me, Charlotte is, I say this with love now. Now I'm saying this with a lot of love. Charlotte is very metaphysical, far more than me, but I respect that, as I have the highest respect for that. And she told me, she said, "Let me tell you something, brother. As long as we're trying to do the right thing, the universe will make a way."
Right on.
I looked at her, I said, "What universe?" I said, "That's the damnedest Oprah Winfreyism I ever heard in my life. But you want to know something? Explain this. I have no scientific, empirical reasoning that to explain this." But she's right. There have been a million and one times when our backs have been against the wall. And I said, "I don't know what we're going to do. Something will happen. Something will come to the fore that allows us to keep going." Charlotte, is it because we're trying to do the right thing?
Say what?
I said, "You got to wake up now."
Yeah, and what you were saying is absolutely true, MC. And I, you know, when I always like to let people know, you know how the media talks about we fled, they flee, and all that. No, no, no. It was an escape. And an escape is a systematic, well thought out plan of what you're going to do. And I like the fact that you mentioned that it was the white left. You know, to me, it's like a modern day underground railroad that helped us to escape. It really, if you look at all aspects of what the Underground Railroad was about, you know, those people who helped us and have continued to help us, of course, is people in the African-American community and the African community, people from all over the world who continue to support our efforts. But that was a modern day Underground Railroad. And not only that, I look at us and I know that we are modern day Maroons.
Right on.
I just gave a talk on what Maroons is, and there's a list of different things that define what a Maroon is. And MJP, when you look at a picture, when you look at the word Maroon, you're going to see our pictures there. Because that's what we continue to be. We escape with our principles, with our love, with the service in our heart, and went up into the foothills of Mount Meru.
All thousands of people.
You know, and established the United African Alliance Community Center that's been going on all these years and is so loved and respected. If you ask any young people, if you ask elders in our community and beyond about us and how we continue to inspire the young people, you know, that's an honor. And that's what keeps us on track, you know?
It is that, absolutely true. And I'm going to tell you something. Please don't think, if you remember the evils that existed back in the day, if you remember COINTELPRO, somehow people say, I've talked to some of them. Yeah, isn't that horrible? But that was a long time ago. Oh, no. Please, please believe me when I tell you. COINTELPRO is alive. It does evil, dirty tricks that they've done. There are comrades of mine that are in jail. Ed Poindexter is one. Been in jail out of Omaha, Nebraska for as long as I've been in exile. Right. And he's in horrible health. And these are some of the things. This is what revolution is about. You've got to fight the wrongs that exist. You have to be the monkey wrench in the cogs of the elitist machinery. You've got to fight, got to take a position against it, and that's what we're doing. But believe me on this one thing. I want you all to remember this. Believe me when I tell you, I know COINTELPRO still exists. The dirty truth still exists.
Pete. Now, I may have been like that years ago, but I got hit with a counterintelligence program when I had the Cafe Molinage in D.C. It was a community cafe, and they scared my partner, who was like 22 years old, a graduate from Howard University. They turned her against me. I didn't find out that we were under this observation until I left the cafe, until I was kind of forced to leave the cafe. And I started reading articles on the internet when I was in Atlanta, because I left under Marshall Eddie Conway's advisement. I had left and went to Atlanta, and I went to one of the libraries downtown Atlanta and jumped online. And I read, and I was trying to keep up what was going on with the cafe, because it was my baby. You know, that's where the Marshall Eddie Conway Children's Free Breakfast Program was founded, in that cafe, in Cafe Molinage. in Washington, D.C. So I clicked on to a story, to a website that was called Inside D.C. And it explained, it was written by the son of one of the state troopers that was guarding Asada Shakur's hospital door when they brought her in, when they first brought her in off the interstate. And okay. He was ragging the cafe to pieces. And that's when I knew that we were being watched, you know, that they had turned my partner against me. They had formed a task force just to harass me. When I would come outside the cafe and go for a walk, the task force would pull up on me intimidatingly. And I would take a step, I would light a Newport and take a step back. To them, I was lighting a cigarette. To me, I was getting in my fighting stance because I knew all I had was one shot and they were going to beat the hell out of me because I didn't, me and my boy years before got jumped by 20-something police in the 4th District Police Station. We was fighting for our lives. So I knew I was going to get my butt tore up, but I had to get mine in quick. But anyway, they would say things to me like, it'll be a shame if we find heroin in the comforts of your couches in your cafe. Another time, they beat a junkie, a black female, right in front of me, trying to provoke me to do something. And it broke my heart, you know, because I was the spearhead of that cafe. It's something that happened to me, you know, but I wanted to act on it, but I couldn't, you know. And they would do things like that. Yeah. They would send police openly into the cafe. And they sent some young Puerto Rican police in there. And I trapped them with my cooking. They used to come back just to get fried plantains. And and they started cooperating with me. The next thing I know, they no longer used to come through. It was almost as if they told them, nah, y'all getting too comfortable with them. We sent you over there to observe and harass them, not to eat and have a good time.
I didn't have a time with them yet.
Right on. And we were, and come to find, the DCPD was observing us. Because I had prayed with some black Muslims on the line of the State Department after 9/11, the State Department was involved. And here I'm sitting maybe like, and I'm doing all this revolutionary activity and I'm upset, you know, out the cafe because we had political breakfast program, poetry, music, all this type of thing. And I'm like, why are they harassing me? And then I forget that the FBI building is only 10 blocks from the cafe, you know? Yeah. So we were, yeah. And yeah, so I know firsthand that they are active. And I didn't have any family in Atlanta. So I had to go to a shelter, one of the craziest shelters in Atlanta. And like 2 weeks later, this older gentleman popped up. And he was like, yeah, I saw those books that you got on your bed there. Yeah, I read those books. And he cut into me. And I'm always paranoid. Freeman and Shuja Graham used to sit me down and they talked to me, used to talk to me for hours about their experiences back in the 70s and 80s. So they kind of had me, you know, with that mindset to observe and know that I could be possibly under observation and everything. And he disappeared 2 weeks later. But I always felt like he was sent in there out of all those people. You know, he supposed to been this political guy in the community. And when I checked him out, nothing read. And but yeah, I wanted to tell that story and let people know here on the People's Dinner Party that it's out here, you know. But I want to turn this back over to you because it's not the sunny show. I'm fanning out right now.
No,
y'all, look, that. I'm doing everything I can to contain myself, but I'm fanning out right now. So look, I'm gonna turn it don't back over to y'all yourself. Here.
Don't contain yourself. This is the truth show. This is yes, what sir. It's about. You're talking yes, sir. Truth, brother. And yes, you're sir. Talking truth that people need to be aware of.
Yes, sir.
So how are you holding?
I'm holding good. You know, many people know about our history as Black Panther veterans. Many people know that we went to Algeria and there were other exiles there. And I mean, it's no secret that, you know, Brother Sekou was there and a whole bunch of other exiles and Brother, who was the brother who had the real low voice, I'm saying, went to Zambia. And he wrote, capitalism plus drugs equal genocide. I can't believe I can't recall his name, but you know, wait, it's coming.
Capitalism plus dope equals genocide.
Yes, and his name was, he had Michael, a name.
Michael Tabor, his.
Yes.
And he lived in Zambia for the longest in exile. When we left Algeria, he left a week before me.
Yes.
And we left in increments, you know.
Yeah, so many people know that story. A lot of that's been documented. But what many people don't know is that when we came to Tanzania and were welcomed as political exiles and freedom fighters, and we became homesteaders. Now, there's not many people in exile who learn to work the land or even desire to work the land. There's one that comes to mind with Brother DC, who was also in Don Cox, who was also in Algeria. And when everybody left, he went to France and became a farmer, farming what is those flowers that like calm people down and everything? And they
lavender.
Lavender. He became a lavender farmer. But people don't understand, brother. Wow. We were urban youth. Well, we wasn't youth. Well, I wasn't still a youth. M.J. certainly wasn't a youth. And we knew nothing about farming. Right. We learned how to be farmers. We learned how to grow our own food. We wasn't calling it organic because that name hadn't come to the fore yet, but it was all right. Organic. We had cows. We had thousands of chickens. We had rabbits. We had pigs, which is probably why I'm a vegetarian now, but hey, we don't have to go into that. But pigs get a bad rep. Pigs are smarter than dogs. I ain't talking about the two-legged kind.
Oh, I heard.
Four-legged kind, huh? And if you keep their environment clean, they're not smelly at all. We learn how to use our hands. I used to be so proud of the calluses in my hands. Brother Pete learned how to build a windmill. Now, how many people who grew up in Kansas City have built a windmill?
Huh? Wow.
When we first, yes, you know, so he has always been very innovative, very inventive. And that is one of the things that the elders in the community in Embassani Village, which is where we live now, which is where United African Alliance Community Center is, that's why they gave us a plot of land. And that's where we first built our first community center. It was African Alliance. No, it was African American Community Center, because you know how Africans from the diaspora who were born in America or referred to as African Americans, later on we changed that name to African Alliance because we felt that demonstrated more our philosophy. Huh?
Right.
But brother, we worked the land for years. Wow. You ever milked a cow?
I never milked a cow, but I seen pictures of what y'all started off with, that little rusty tin shack or whatever the case may be, and all that land. Man, that was a hell of a adjustment to make. That was a hell of an adjustment to make, and wow, You know, I know that took a lot of hard work and dedication to put that together. That's why, like, I'm not amazed by, you know, for nothing, you know, by y'all's story, you know. And, yeah, I've seen y'all humble beginnings, you yeah. know, and how Pete had to adjust as well. You know, I was watching the documentary, and I'm, you know, and I'm and the brother was on there talking about how they chased the guy in the market with a knife or something like that. He's like, "Yo, we don't do that here in Texas."
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm like, "Hey, he's from Kansas. He's from the Midwest. Kansas That's how City. You know how you get down, baby."
Now, just for the record, let me tell this story. We were parked, it was night, we were in Arusha town, yes. and I'm driving, and we were parked in front of a church building, I think across the street from the post office. And Charlotte was heavily pregnant with our daughter. She opened the door to get heavily pregnant. Now, when I tell the story, he looked like George Foreman or Mike Tyson. I may be exaggerating.
Of course.
He came in on a motorcycle and came so close to her door, she had to fall back in the car to keep from getting hit. I said, "Benta, politely, what the hell is wrong with you?" And the dude looked at me, he said, "Well, what you gonna do about it?" And you don't do that to people from 12th Street in Kansas City. Those are words you don't know. I had a machete in there. I took that machete and jumped over. This dude ran into the church building screaming, "Ay-ay!" And I had to go hide out for a while surprisingly, right. This is the truth. His father was a church. I've always been interested in electronics and stuff like that. His father was a teacher of electronics. And somehow they met me and I met them. We became friends. The father taught me a great deal about electronics that I didn't know. So you can use anything as as a foundation on which to build. So we did do so.
Life is mysterious like that.
Yep. It is. And please, I want people to know, I am 83 years old now. I can resolve anything with a smile. I can resolve, and I do it. I don't argue or fight with nobody. I don't have to, because I'm smart enough to know how to resolve things peacefully.
That's right.
So I just wanted to get that in there now.
Yeah.
Cool beans.
Yeah, cool beans. So we were talking about the homesteading and how when we first started clearing the land, because we were so close to one of the game reserves, there would be hyenas who would get all in there. There would be Cape buffalo who are huge. Wow. Who would be running up and down the road and all of that, you know. So that just shows you the conditions that we had when we first
moved
there. Not only did we not have electricity, and that's why Brother Pete had to go to an appropriate technology class to learn how to build a windmill, we also didn't have running water. And the people, not only us, but the people in our community, in our village there. And it was the girls' task to carry buckets of water, like 20-liter buckets of water. So when our comrade, Brother Geronimo Jijaga, was finally released from prison, you know, Johnny Cochran was his lawyer, and he was, like, awarded, like, a compensation for having been locked up for 27 years for something. And so he went to Ghana first, then he came to Tanzania. And when he came to Tanzania, to our center, he asked us what was our greatest need. Right. And our greatest need at the time was water, not only for us, but for the whole community there. And he gave us like $10,000 to drill. To drill. I remember there was an Australian drill crew that came out of Serengeti and came to us, and we had to take down some of our fence. And it took them maybe 4 days, I think, to drill until they reached an underground stream.
Water passage.
Yes. And when that happened, and that water just went up like that, you and everybody's cheering and howling, you would think that it was like, what they
call
oil. And the first thing that we did was put faucets out there for our community.
Yeah.
And that is still being in use to this day. And I got to give thanks to Betty Shabazz International Charter School out of Chicago, who raised funds for us to have an immersible pump.
They raised funds for us to get a high-pressure submersible pump and to build a gigantic water tank that holds thousands and thousands of gallons of water. So when there's no water in the village, you can always get, people used to have to walk 5 miles to get a bucket of water. So this is because of the generosity of people that have helped us accomplish some of the things that we've accomplished.
I got a story about how I met Geronimo, how I met, he gave me permission to call him G. You know, how I met G. There was a free the political prisoner rally in front of the White House, and I met so many people there. I was standing like right up the street, and G just got out, and he was with his wife and everything at the time. And I never forget this. It was like a rite of passage, and it was this ginormous Marcus Garvey flag, like it was huge. And G was trying to hold it, and I walked up, and we held it together, and we walked that flag all the way around the White House until we got to the back. And then when we got to the back, he just handed the flag off to me. And I always felt like, you know, he was passing the torch to me in my own little mind. And that's the first time I ever met him. When we were doing the march, I had stepped on the back of his heel, and I was like, man, I melted down to about this big. I was like, me and my big feet, I done stepped on this revolutionary's foot. And he was cool about it. And then years later, I met him again at Malink's house down in New Orleans during the Katrina aftermath. And we was in recovery mode when I actually met him. And it was amazing to meet this brother, how calm, how cool he was. And I would run volunteers down to Morgan City, where he's from, to help do repairs on his mom's house down there. And it was amazing. I used to see him a lot, and it was just amazing that one minute you're reading about, you know, folks, and then years later, you know, they're calling you by name, you know. And it was just so amazing. He was a wonderful brother. It crushed me to find out, you know, when he passed. You know, sometimes I feel like, you know, black people can't have nothing. We can't have we can't have Tupac, we can't have Biggie, but the damn Rolling Stones, like 90 years old, they still going strong. Look, a question that I had when I was watching the PBS documentary on y'all, the attitude, the vibe of the people in Tanzania where y'all live, it seemed like so beautiful and so laid back, you know, not like intense like how the city is here, you know. So what is it like to live, you know, amongst the folks in Tanzania there where you live at? What's it like? How are they?
Well, that, Please let me try to describe this. Okay. When Charlotte first went back to the United States in 1990, after being out here 20 years, 1990, she came back, she said, Zay, let me know. She said, it's wild over there. She said, when I was in the airport, she said, have you ever seen cartoons where everybody just runs around in circles and it's just jumping, going back and forth? That's what everybody's moving at, hyper speed and talking and moving fast. And things are laid back here. People will stop you in the morning, and you know, I still have to deal with this because I still have a little bit of that Americanism in me, that fast, 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 you know. People will stop, well, MJ Peter, how are you? I said, I'm fine, I'm doing good. And what about Mama C, Mama Shaw? I said, oh, she's fine. Your kids are in the States. I said, well, some of them are, one of them's here now. Oh, really? Are they doing okay? This is the way people are. And they don't say do this just to be nice. They do it with sincerity.
Right.
They want to know how you are. I've been under the weather. And I just told Charlotte, my neighbor came, and not my biological daughters, but my adopted daughters came and said, neighbor's here to see you. They want to see you, and they want us to. I said, oh, God, I don't feel like that. I said, tell them to come on in. They came in, and they sat here for an hour. Right. How are you? How are you doing? I said, well, I've been a little sick, but I'm okay now. But you shouldn't be in this room by yourself. I said, well, I'm not. I said, people come in and out and everything. But what about at nighttime? I said, well, I can make it during the night, you know. But people are concerned. So anyway, this yes. is the way it is. Laid back was the perfect phrase to use.
Right.
Because people are laid back. They are just as laid back as they possibly can. Charlotte has been, I've spent a great deal of time in bed. Right. And Charlotte has been renovating my room. And she's got people doing this and they're doing that. And that everybody's so pleasant. And they come in, how are you, MZ? And I mean, it's, you know, you can say, how are you?
Right.
And it has that fakeness to it. There has no sincerity.
Right.
This is from the heart. This is the way people are.
Right.
People are very polite. They're very
right.
kind.
Right.
They do have crazy people like they do everywhere in the world, but it is rare.
You know, we work with a lot of the youth, and I work with a lot of the hip-hop community, right?
Right.
And I love hip-hop here because it's full of respect. It's full
right.
of youth who see the importance of elevating the community through their words
right.
and through their actions. You know,
right.
you know, I know there's pockets of conscious hip-hop here in the States, but you don't hear it on the radio, really. You know,
you gotta seek it out.
Because of the corporations, and we were talking about Brother Geronimo. Well, his nephew is out of Chicago, and he has a program where they're trying to stop the corporations from pushing all this violence and terrible things
Thank
they say
you.
About women
Thank
and
you.
All that. But I'm
Thank
saying
you.
This to say
Thank
that
you.
The young people here have a lot of respect for elders. That's something that, of course, when I come to the States or anywhere in the world, I'm honored with a lot of respect. But a whole bunch of young people, you know, aren't like that. They're not, it's like they've forgotten that, you know?
Right.
So when MZ says that everybody is laid back here, that is so very true. Everyone is helpful. You know, you can have a car breakdown in the middle of somewhere and people don't even know you, but they will come to your aid to help push that car or to get under that hood or whatever. Right. But you receive that kind of respect when you give that kind of respect, you know? And when you, a whole bunch of Afros is what we call our tribe, or considering coming here, many people here, I mean Tanzania, and many people have, but always tell them, you got to be prepared to put something on the table. It don't necessarily have to be financial, but it needs to be something, some knowledge that you can share, or something. And don't stay in these little cliques, you know what I mean? Where you're just in the community that is a diasporan community. If you're going to be accepted, for lack of a better word, into a community, you got to embrace the community and be a part of
that. No doubt. If I can have permission to speak, Elder.
Yes, you have permission.
I want to loop back to like attitude. I always said, you know, that the best way to express the African in me is how I treat people. The elders taught me, Shuja and Elder Freeman taught me that sometimes you gotta be mother, brother, father, sister, psychiatrist, you know, to the people. And that's my approach. I have a lot of different I got survivor programs here and also we're reporting, this podcast is reporting out of one of the most dangerous projects in Cleveland, the Wilson Towers. I'm up at the Wilson Towers, and the thing that I, you know, the most heartbreaking thing, I've been here about a decade. The most heartbreaking thing about living in the project and being political is you identify that the music does two things to these projects all across the United States. One, it's a breeding plantation. This music is transforming these projects into breeding plantations. One.
Yes.
Two, they're also creating bodies for all the future prisons as well.
Yeah.
And it's nothing to walk outside and kick bullets that were fired by Draco maybe like 4:30 in the morning. It's rough here. We had a young lady pass away from a fentanyl overdose. She was just 30 years old. And the people that was with her just left her out in the hallway. You know, and knocked on the door and ran. You know, it's a lot to deal with. But I'm the only one like myself here. So I don't get in people's business. I don't really get involved because I gotta stay in the middle of the road if I'm gonna be continue to be a leader here. And the funny thing is, it's such a void of men in the community that even the older people kind of see me as a father figure, which is mad weird to me. Really weird to me. But it was explained to me that you've been the most consistent thing in these people probably in their life. And I don't, and I say I a lot, but as you know, when I was talking to you a couple of days ago, Saturday, there's some days I can barely punch my way out of a wet paper bag, sister and brother. So I know it's a force much greater than myself that's guiding me, because, I mean, it's my show, so I guess I can say this. I'm a damn fool sometimes. you know? So I know the resources that come to me for the community here is coming through something much greater than me. I'm just the conductor. You know, I have the desire. The majority of my building people are going through trauma, mental health issues, serious drug and alcohol addiction. But I don't stand above them.
old socialist saying that I picked up when I was with the International Socialist Organization. I don't wish to rise above the rank and file. I want to rise with the rank and file. I want to rise with my people. It's hard on me. It's very hard on me, very difficult, but I take the work with a great deal of honor because they're like, the universe put me here for a reason.
Yes.
And I see it. And I see it. And I'm like, you know, I wasn't really anybody, but it took me, cleaned me up and put me in position to be productive, you know, to this world. And all I really want to do in life, you can't bribe me with no sex. You can't bribe me with no money. You can't bribe me with no violence, because I grew up in D.C., you know. D.C. don't really raise no suckers. And I know y'all know something about that, being out of Kansas City, you know. And I'm just honored that it put me in this position.
If I may, forgive my rudeness. You just described my life to a T. The struggle gave my life significance and meaning. It cleaned me up. It made me a whole, caring, conscious human being. It made me understand that not a damn thing revolves around me. And my only significance lies in what help, what assistance I'm able to give to my people. And that's just true. And that's what gives me joy. That's what, no matter how difficult things, and things do get difficult, no matter how difficult they do get, when I wake up in the morning, when I go to the restroom and I see my reflection in the mirror, I don't cringe.
This right here, I wanted to be an homage to y'all love. I wanted to be an homage to y'all love to the people. You know, black love.